stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
You're listening to CITR 101.9. Broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Halkomelem-speaking Musqueam people.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the Food Bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime. Across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
Hello, this is CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. My name is Josh. You're listening to Textbook here on CITR. This is a student show. We deal with academics and storytelling and extracurricular club stuff, but it's more than that. It's Textbook. Not so textbook. Textbook, but also not so textbook. So, it's kind of a mixed bag. Today, first segment is with CVC. If you don't know what CVC is, a little rundown. They're a massive club on campus. It's the Chinese Varsity Club. It is like 800 members. There are 50 executives. That's just 50 people running things. It has a really vibrant history, and I talked to three of the executives about the club, about what they're doing, about what they're all about, because for a lot of people, it's a whole part of the campus that they're not super aware of and not super super familiar with, so I thought it would be cool to talk to them and kind of figure out what's up. Again, this is a talk that I did last week with CVC, three executives from CVC. This is starting it off over on Textbook. Again, CITR 101.9 FM. Hello, this is Textbook, CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. Today, I'm here with two execs from the Chinese Varsity Club. Fellas, can you introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Michael Tran. I'm the Vice President External for the Chinese Varsity Club. I'm studying business, fifth year marketing.
I'm Nathan. I'm in fourth year studying kinesiology right now, and I'm Vice President Internal of CVC.
Great. Thank you so much for being with me today. Can you tell me a little bit about what CVC is all about? What do you guys do?
Well, CVC, I would say, is UBC's largest social club. What we really focus on is providing opportunities for people to meet other people in unique settings. So that's everything from like sports to parties to our ski trip to drama productions. We just want to make sure that everyone has a new way to find other great people.
I'd say CVC is also a place where you can make memories. It doesn't matter how crazy or how cool those are, you're going to end up with a story if you come hang out with us, something that you can share with your buddies and your friends for sure.
We are big on stories here at CITR. Why don't you guys tell me how you both got involved with the clubs originally?
All right, I'll start. So I came in as a first year, and I applied as a first year representative. We call them froshies in the club. And so it was really just Imagine Day. I found really the biggest, loudest club there was in CVC. I saw a bunch of black and yellow balloons going up into the sky outside, and I just was drawn to the music and the energy and the people. That's how I got involved, and ever since then, like, it's been the same. It's just been a huge amount of energy, huge amount of positivity that's kept me going to the club, and that's kind of one of my standout memories.
I think unlike Nathan, we both reached the same end goal, but we got there through two different ways. I actually joined in my third year at UBC after one of my really close friends from first year res had finally taken 2 years to convince me to join the club. She would pester me every day and night. Hey, come out to this event. Hey, Mike, you should try this one. Hey, come out to this. Why don't you find the interview? And finally, when I couldn't find anything else on campus, I turned to CVC and I really haven't looked back. Again, like Nathan said, the positivity, the energy is just something that's unmatchable. And after entering for a couple other clubs, I'm just happy to say I'm finally here.
Why don't you guys tell me the eight departments of CVC? What kind of activities go on?
Well, I guess the easiest one to talk about for me is the external relations department. So we handle all sponsorship and partnerships as well as outside communication with the club. We have other departments like community, which focuses on the charitable acts and community involvement. Cultural, which focuses on highlighting other cultures in the community through different events. Like we have a movie night coming up. We're embracing Indian culture, playing Slumdog Millionaire, and providing a little bit of food.
Yeah, some of the other ones we can go into the technical side as well, where of course we have our media department handling all of our lovely photos, videography, all of that. So everything you see in terms of our photos or videos on Facebook, things like that, thanks and shout out to them for putting all that together. Our communications department as well does all of our graphics, our Facebook events, Instagram, all of that. They do a wonderful job getting our name out there. We have, as I mentioned, the first year representatives are Froshies. They're just a group of first years at UBC, and they kind of dabble in all of it. They get that first year experience, and we try our best to nurture them, help them get exposed to university and CVC as a whole. We're missing a couple.
So we also have events. So although all of our departments run events, we have one department called events. This department is really in charge of our big flagship events like our icebreakers, our end of year member appreciation event, as well as our annual Super Skills talent show. We also have our sports department. So our sports department runs our six different intramural league teams, which each have about 15 to 20 people. So if anyone is ever looking to sign up for sports, you know, they're the place to go to. We also have our ski trip department. So they are in charge of Western Canada's largest ski trip. It's an annual ski trip up at Big White. So we go there for 3 days, two nights. It's always a riot full of skiing and partying. And then obviously we have our big departments, the social department. So they're in charge of all clubbing events, all ages dances. At the end of the day, they're really the life of the club. So they're great.
Describe the atmosphere of the CVC office for me.
Yeah, I'd say the CVC office is a place where if you need a microwave or a fridge, it's the place to go. Not only that, but the CVC office is somewhere where you can come in and you know you can have a great conversation with someone. It doesn't matter who, it doesn't matter if you've met them before or not. You come in and you're welcomed with open arms. Something that we do have in part in the office is that if you need a seat, if you need a place to crash, someone's going to offer the seat for you to come in and join in on the conversation. Doesn't matter what we're talking about, it's some place that we include you right away because everyone has that something to add and we want to hear your side of it, whether it's your first time or your 100th time visiting us. It's never going to change.
What are some of CVC's other main hangout spots? You mentioned Sun Sushi before.
Oh yeah, okay, Sun Sushi is a real gem.
It is a gem. Great sushi,
cheap prices, you know, let's not go down too far, but I love that place at least a couple of times a week. Besides Sun Sushi, we also go to the Sassamat Pho right beside it. That's another local hangout spot, part of CVC. You'll find our execs there almost every day. I guess whether they're hungover or hungry. The other places we go to a lot are Gallery and going to the Pit. So those places, you know, happy hour at the Gallery and then Pit Wednesdays or Pit anytime. Birthdays, every birthday is celebrated in CVC by getting a drink. And when you have 90 people buying you drinks, you know it's going to be a good time.
Where do you guys play sports? What field or facilities do you guys use?
Well, we primarily just play all our sports through UBC Rec, so that's obviously at the SRC. We play volleyball out of War and Osborne, and then Ultimate over at the grass fields, Wolfson and Lord. So we play a lot over there. You can also find a lot of our members and executives out at the Oval playing basketball over there or working out, just like Nathan here.
Also, if you've seen that video of the quickest tip over in the day of the longboat for UBC Rec, that's also us. That was one of our teams. So we are heavily involved in UBC recreation, as Michael said. But it's not just sports. We're also heavily involved in recreations on campus events like Storm the Wall and Longboat.
All right, let's cut to the chase here without being too graphic. What is your favorite party that you attended, CBC party or party, you know, thrown by CBC, organized by the club? Any ones off the top of your head?
Yeah, I guess I'll go with my first party. So entering my first year, you know, I guess that was like 2012 or so. Hey, Mike, what party do you want to go to tonight? Oh, I heard there's a CBC graffiti party going on. Walk in with just me and my one other friend. Have a great night. One of the great highlights of it was that in first year, we were dancing with these two girls, and they're like, oh, hey, what year are you guys in? And then we just stick up our little finger, one. And the other girls just turn and look at us, and they just hold up 3 and 4. But then the rest of the night got even better because I ended up making out with my soon-to-be girlfriend. So, I guess ex-girlfriend now, but, you know,
that almost
still
had a happy ending.
It almost had a happy ending, but it was a great time, and I thought it was super funny because first time in university, first time being at a CBC party, and all these just crazy things happen.
Yeah, I guess for myself, it'd have to be my first one, too, as well. Like, coming from a high school that doesn't really party too much, I come from Richmond, but I came to my first CBC party. The theme was the foam party, and it was in Lada. And it was just, it blew my mind. I was like, is this really what people do with their lives? But when I got in there, just right away, I wanted a piece of it. I wanted to be in the middle of everything. I think I remember being upstairs and just chilling on the sofa because I was just, like, my head was spinning like crazy and the lights just come on. I'm like, oh, I guess it's time to go home now.
What kind of challenges has the club come up against in recent years?
I think the biggest challenges the club has faced is really just trying to overcome the Chinese stigma and controlling such a large group of people. Like with, like I said, with 90 execs, it's hard to make sure that everyone's always on the same page and that we all are kind of following the same morals and values and mission that our really club has set out to be. With regards to other challenges, overcoming Chinese stigma, just because it's in our name. We're the Chinese Varsity Club.
Right. What do you mean by Chinese stigma? When can you define that a little bit for our listeners?
I guess Chinese stigma that to be part of the Chinese Varsity Club or to be involved in it, you have to be Chinese, which is totally a lie. Because to give everyone like a background on it is that we are founded on Chinese heritage because in 1930, when the club was founded, a group of Chinese guys just wanted to play varsity sports, but due to the racism at the time, they actually weren't allowed to. So they made the Chinese Varsity Club so that they could all play sports together. Since then, we've kind of evolved. We've evolved past sports. So sports is only one of our 8 departments, like we've mentioned before. So, yeah, we embrace being Chinese, but it's not doesn't stop anyone from joining or playing with us, partying with us, any of that.
Can you talk a little bit about how expansive the network of CBC former members and former members has kind of gotten?
I think people would be blown away by how influential CBC is outside of university. CBC is more than just a club at university. It's becomes your network outside of it. So some great examples are, I guess, one of our current execs, his dad was a president nearly 50 years ago. One of our old execs who graduated last year, he's interviewing up at Pepsi, and one of the interviewers at Pepsi actually had been part of CBC before as well, and they gave him a great referral because, you know, like people know what to expect from people in CBC. A girl that I was playing Ultimate with, she turned and looked at me and she's like, are you guys in CBC? My parents met in CBC. And then now again, we're working with a company out in Richmond, and out of the blue, he's like, yeah, I just kind of wanted to talk to CBC because I used to go to all their ski trips and all their parties, and it was just a great time. And I was just wondering, like, do you guys still do that? And it's like, yeah, we do. After, like, you know, the 20, 30, 40 years away you are, there's still a common connection on what you did and what the club was founded about.
I think, if you don't mind, I'll add a little bit, is we also just have almost like an international presence sometimes. We actually have a group called CVC Abroad, and it's just obviously in the summer, a lot of our members and a lot of our executives love to travel around the world. And people who've been in CVC before, but of course in different years, whether it's 8 years ago, 16 years ago, whatever, they meet up and they take each other around, whether it's in Thailand, Vietnam, in Europe, just all over the place. You just see this connection that they've never met before, but the fact that they've both been in CVC, they already share this common bond, and they're out making connections and just having fun in a complete foreign country, which I think is incredible.
Yeah, for sure.
Can you tell me what maybe one of your proudest moments has been with CVC? Where have you looked at the club and have been really happy with kind of the ambitions or what has been accomplished?
I guess I could talk to that. I think what you really speak to about like realizing all the ambitions and stuff has been this past year during our retreat, Nathan actually organized this massive retreat for our 90 executives up close to the Sunshine Coast. And on the boat ride back, we were just pulling out of the dock there at the camp. And we kind of just looked back and we looked and realized that like these past 3 and 4 years that we've been a part of this club have shaped up to this, where we've come to a point where we're old enough and mature enough that we can pass on information and help make the lives of younger people better. And in terms of CVC, I think that it doesn't have a lot to do with like what the club is doing, but to know that we can influence future members of the club, future leaders of this campus. And I think that to me is what was really rewarding. Being able to hold workshops for them, show them how to act and communicate professionally, how to develop bonds and strong leadership. I think all that stuff was just, and it's so meaningful to me.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really sticks out to me is that you get a tangible measure of your growth as a person by being in CVC. Like you come in, whatever year it is, you have that set of people that are there in that year, and then every year there's kind of, it changes, right? As people graduate, people, new members, new execs come in, and you actually get to see your growth from what people kind of tell you throughout the years. And for us especially, we both come in as regular executives, just trying to be a part of the club. And then all of a sudden, 4 years later, we're in leadership roles. And it blows our mind to kind of think that people we looked up to, people who were leaders when we came in, did the same thing. And you really get to reflect back and see, like, I've really made an impact in this club. And it's super rewarding to be able to see that concretely in front of you.
Can you tell me about some of the other ways that CVC gives back to the community? You mentioned that there was some volunteer work that you guys do.
Yeah, so I think CVC can give back in a variety of different ways. So a lot of our events we normally host for like charitable causes. So for instance, we have a Spy vs. Spy tournament going on, kind of like Sock Wars, and we're holding it in support of the Canadian Cancer Society, which we've also done a fashion show for before the past 2 years. We also do some regular community involvement, just like going out into the community, handing out sandwiches. I know a couple of our execs, if they don't do it on behalf of CVC, but that we actively try to bring people together to go out to these charity events. We've also done in the past like shoreline cleanups. We've partnered with other clubs like up at SFU to kind of do some charitable work there too. So it's really tough to say because there's so many different charitable causes every year, and which ones we choose to support always change depending on who decides what they're interested in and what other people are interested in.
Where do you see CVC going in the next little while, in the near future?
I'd say in terms of where CVC is going, I'd love to see us continue to embrace this family aspect of us. I see CVC as something that is able to forego the challenges that Mike spoke on in terms of the stigma of being Chinese and this kind of idea that you have to be Chinese to be a part of the club. And I think we're doing a lot of great groundwork, and we have been for the past couple of years, to break out of that zone. And just something that our president, David Tolentino, really sold me on is that beer doesn't discriminate. Partying doesn't discriminate. It doesn't matter who you are. We pick up a beer, we have a great time, and it really doesn't matter what your background is. That just kind of unifies everybody. And I think that's where we really see CVC going, is continue to push that boundaries, that no matter what kind of challenges we may face, we never let go of the fact that we're a family to begin with, and we're not just a family enclosed. We're opening that up to everybody around.
Nathan and Michael, it's been great having you on the show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Josh.
Thank you, Josh.
Hello, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the traditional ancestral and unceded territory of the Musqueam people. You just heard Fountain's track. I'm going to pull it up. This is embarrassing of me to not know this. Anyways, you just heard Fountain. I'll explain. I'll give the full track ID later. Before that, you heard an interview with CVC, Michael and Nathan from CVC. With me now in the studio, I have Tom Nakini. Tom, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. This is Tom's first time on the radio, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Wow, great, exciting. Tom is here to talk about his time playing the bagpipes. This is for our middle segment. This is the story segment. Mostly we're just talking about whatever, but sometimes cool stories happen, so that's kind of fun. How did you get into bagpipes in the first place?
I was just a really weird kid. I'm not even Scottish. But I would see a bagpiper playing outside of all the Canucks games and sports games. There's something really visceral about it. And I bothered my parents continuously until they let me play. And then he also would always have a ton of money in his case while he was busking. And so I thought it was like just a genuine job, because as a kid, when you see like $200 in cold hard cash, it's like two Xboxes.
Right.
So it was, to me, the ideal job. So that's how I sort of started.
Did you like the music though?
Yeah, I definitely liked the music. It was both. I think as I started playing though more and doing more research, and it was that the initial hook was the wow, what a cool career.
Yeah.
And then upon like getting into the culture, that's when I really started to love the music, especially because it's different. I already had a musical background in piano, but it's a very, very different kind of genre.
So how old were you when you started playing?
Nine years of bothering my parents.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, so it was a long time coming. And you were in elementary school.
Yes.
And you start playing, and what? How do you even go about getting lessons? I feel it's really obscure, like a pretty obscure instrument.
Well, that was actually the initial challenge, was just that it's hard to find someone to teach you. Luckily, in the Lower Mainland, Simon Fraser University sponsors one of the world's best pipe bands.
Wow.
And underneath that is a subsidiary of pipe bands called the Robert Malcolm Memorial Pipe Bands. And they train you from the very start. So I started there, but it was a pretty big commute. It was about like an hour and a half drive, like every once or twice every week. And so eventually someone from that band knew of a teacher in Vancouver who became my teacher and mentor until now. So then I had close lessons that were only 20 minutes away.
What was the community like? What are the people that play in this pipe band like?
Really Scottish.
Okay.
I think that's sort of the norm, is that pretty much everyone has had parents who are somehow Scottish or involved in, like, grew up playing the bagpipes, Highland dancing, in some way a part of the Highland community. I was definitely a bit of an outsider. There's an expression that goes, it takes five generations to make a piper.
Okay.
To make a really good piper. And so I was starting completely fresh.
You're generation one.
Yeah,
there.
Generation one piper, exactly.
And like, it's mostly male, right?
Yes and no. I think it used to be, but there's a lot of female pipers playing.
Cool.
There are a lot of female drummers as well, because the pipe bands involve pipers and drummers. And then there's also a huge Highland dance component, which is mainly female, but it's not completely divided.
Yeah. So when you're first playing with this band and like, were you doing performances of some sort? What was that like? What was the kind of end goal?
Yeah. So after the Robert Malcolm Memorial Band and my private teacher, I moved to the White Spot Pipe Band, and all of these bands compete against each other. And so every summer you sort of go on tour to all of the different Highland games across the West Coast, or even across the North America or to Scotland. And along the West Coast, at least, there's all the Highland games get tallied together. So you want to win in the Highland games. You normally have one or two competitions as a band. You also have solo competitions, and you're graded by judges for those. And then if you win that, you win, obviously, the award at the actual Highland games. But if you win all of them in total or get the highest average, then you win also the BC Highland games, like, overall. There's trophies and scholarships and all that kind of stuff to be won.
Whoa, serious?
Yeah.
I'm thinking the West Coast, is it because there's like a prominent like Scottish community? Yeah. Like, where did this community?
Yeah, so really interesting, actually. Outside of Scotland, the largest population of pipers is in the Lower Mainland, because there was a huge immigration of Scots. So that's sort of where the culture started to arise. And it's funny because I think it sort of evolved on its own too. There is definitely a connection between the different Highland games, but it's funny, some of the weird things that I know about Scottish culture, that my friends who were born and raised like full blooded Scotsmen or Scotswomen, right, like, would have never experienced.
Because these games, tell me a little bit about these games themselves. Like, this seems like hyper Scottish, even.
Yeah. So I'll talk about the Bellingham Highland Games, just because if anyone ever gets a chance, it is one of the funnest things to go do. It's a really, really extreme version of the Highland Games. So pretty much you have tons of people decked out in full Highland kits, so wearing kilts, sporrans, uniforms, all that kind of stuff. You normally have all the bands coming together, and you do this thing called the mass bands at the opening and closing of the games. So about 20 plus pipe bands all get together and march down an entire field. There's sword fighting, traditional like Scottish country dancing. It's really interesting because you get these vendors that come from all around the states, and this is sort of their like trade show. And so there's people selling really obscure like Scottish items. So like all the different daggers, all huge swords, kilts, all that kind of stuff, Scottish import stores. And so that's why it does kind of have this like Scotland condensed atmosphere going. Like, in Scotland, I doubt you would go to a store that would have like Iron Brew, every type of Scottish tea, every type of shortbread you could ever imagine. And then also all of these different, because a lot of people go to the games to identify with their Scottish heritage. So there's all of these different books and speakers and lectures that they'll take your name and tell you all about your entire family history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
that real lineage stuff.
Yeah, so in fact, I was adopted into a clan. My last name is Nicchini, okay. Which is Italian, but it's somehow related through Scandinavia to the McNichol or Nichol family in Scotland.
Oh, great.
And they needed a piper, so I actually have played for them in the past and am a member of the McNichol clan.
Wow. tell me about some of the characters you were meeting at these games. Like, what are these people like?
So there's the piping community, which kind of has its own set of characters. And there's like a guy who looks like Sean Connery, who's the head of One Pipe Band. There's all the different instructors, and especially because a lot of them are your judges, you kind of get to know their personalities, and on the sidelines you kind of make fun of them, so I might not air some of that on the radio. But there's also just general characters that are around. There are a lot of people who come dressed up for the games, and as a like competitor, for the most part, we go to the games not dressed in our Highland kit. When we have to play, we get changed into our clothes, and then we get out of them because they're uncomfortable and stuffy. And we don't want to look, we thought we looked weird. But there are people who come to the games, and they've gone, like, 20 times more than our uniform. And also just, you can tell that, like, sometimes people come, like, dressed in the wrong era or from the wrong place in the world. So it's not even about necessarily Scotland. It's just almost like an excuse to sort of...
To dress up.
To dress up. Yeah. And also to, like, I think look at history too, because everyone's definitely dressed in historic clothes. It's not like you have people dressed like aliens, but they could be dressed in historic British fashion or French fashion. And so there's like women in corsets, men doing the full Braveheart thing. Which is funny because some of the fake Scottish heritage isn't actually true, and you see a lot of it at the Highland Games. So it's almost become true because people do it.
It's been kind of inscribed to this national consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And what were your teachers like? What was your kind of engagement with the community like?
So I was fortunate in that I was the pipe major of the White Spot Pipe Band. So that meant that I was the head of my group. So I was doing all the conducting and everything. So I had a really close relation to a lot of the teachers, which was really nice. A lot of them sort of specialized in different areas. Some of them were pipers, some of them were drummers. And I kind of got to be in the mix of it all because I was helping coordinate everything. There's a lot of pipers who were our teachers, and they come from families where it's all they do. So one of the families that helped out in my pipe band, they are the pipe major and pipe sergeant, so the number one and number two of the Dowco Triumph Street Pipe Band, and their kids played in the pipe band and their daughters danced, and it's like a whole kind of thing. And the Simon Fraser University Pipe Band, the other sort of top tier pipe band in the Lower Mainland, the entire family all play in the pipe band at various levels.
And later on too, you'd go on to do some busking with the bagpipes. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so bagpipes, like there's an expression that goes, now it's time to pay the piper. Because when you get hired for private gigs and stuff, it's normally quite expensive to hire a bagpiper. And I was doing that, but it was kind of sustaining me through the school year in high school. But when I wanted to go traveling and stuff, I realized that I needed a proper job. But I had this tool and I figured I might as well try it out because I've seen pipers busking. And in fact, that was my initial inspiration. So I got my busker's license, which was difficult to get actually because that year they'd banned bagpiping. But then Gregor Robertson came in and said it was part of Vancouver's cultural heritage and brought it back. Because it was
a champ.
Yeah, Gregor. So it was over like 20 decibels or something. I can't remember the exact volume. And then I started busking, and it turned out to be sort of the best summer job you could get. You'd play for 45 minutes to an hour in different locations downtown, get to interact with people, and it paid really, really well. So I funded most of my travels that way up until the last year.
Wow, that's fantastic. What were some of your spots to busk?
Yeah, there are some good spots.
Can you say them?
Some bad spots. Yeah, definitely. Okay. I mean, I might upset some other buskers, but that's right. The best spot I had in the city was Granville and Robson. It's right underneath the Future Shop there. And that's sort of your guaranteed. If you're there between like 3 to 6 on a summer day, you're you're going to get tons and tons of foot traffic. Robson and Burrard is also pretty decent. But the absolute best one is if you look up the cruise ship schedule and head to the flagpoles.
Oh, God.
Right outside Canada Place. And especially if you line it up with an American cruise ship because of the dollar bills that aren't useful to them anymore. So you just line up and sit outside of the flagpoles. I had a bit of an advantage in that I have a full traditional Highland kit, so which are they're kind of an expensive investment to get into, but I do, and so I look the part and everything, because there also is another guy who plays the bagpipes on stilts with dressed like a fawn. And
oh my God, that's hard to compete with, though.
Yeah, it's hard to compete with, but people often like I think what he's doing is really cool, but I have people who come to me that are like, I'm so happy you're doing it sort of the traditional way.
Because the fawn thing is a little gimmicky.
Yeah, and especially because for a lot of people, bagpipes in Scottish culture, they're played at weddings, funerals, memorial services. Like I've had people come up to me and tell me about the last time when they immigrated from Scotland on a boat, the town, like all the people who are leaving the town hired a piper to play them off. So there's a lot of emotion.
Ceremonial.
Yeah. So for them, the fawn thing is a bit of, it doesn't match their emotional sentiment to bagpipes. So when I play, it kind of does. So that's, you end up with a lot of people crying. Especially God. Like people of older generations, because I think it was more common to have them at weddings and funerals and stuff. So that is occasionally awkward because it's just your job. But then at the same time, they pay you really well. So if you can break people down into tears, it's like almost a good thing. Bit of an ethical dilemma.
Yeah, that's a good one, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
A little bit of a catharsis. I can't blame you.
Yeah, but I would sometimes switch to Amazing Grace if I saw like a group of old ladies coming.
Tom, thank you so much for talking about your pipes today here on Textbook.
Yeah, no worries.
We'll have you on the show again. You're a jack of all trades, so I'm sure there'll be other things to
talk
about.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Tom. I'm going to play a couple ads real quick, and then I'll plunge into another segment. So here it is.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Hey, this is Textbook CITR 101.9 FM. The song you heard before my interview with Tom, it was by Fountain. It was Emerald Rising. I just wanted to give the proper station ID to that. Fountain are great. You should really check them out. Next up is an interview with Omar Perezi. Omar is going to talk a little bit about a paper for the Tell Me About Your Paper segment. I hope you guys enjoy this. CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Josh. This is Textbook. It goes every Tuesday, 4 to 5 p.m. The next show after me is Discorded Radio, which you should absolutely listen to. A great radio show about a great magazine. So I want to give them a shout out too. So here's my interview with Omar, which I did earlier today. Thanks.
So basically, my house just got renovated in Indonesia, and it got like torn down, and like we built it from scratch again. But then during this period, my dad got moved. Like, he got transferred to Singapore, which then, like, all my family had to move to Singapore as well. So the house been, like, empty. We have, like, a housekeeper, but the house is, like, empty with no furniture for, like, the longest time. It was, like, 3 years. There's no one there. And my housekeeper brought his family in this one fine day for like a holiday, because like I live in the city and like my housekeeper's like family lives in a village a couple hours away, and his wife was walking around in my backyard nearby Sunset, and suddenly this woman appeared out of nowhere. And she was young, she was walking in my living room, and then they made eye contact, and this woman like smiled at her and disappeared, like just vanished just instantly. And I was just like, oh wow, like my housekeeper told me about this when we were like smoking a cigarette together. And then I didn't believe it. I was just like, oh wow, I mean, that's just one case. And then this summer, I woke up in the middle of the night. I was staying in that house, and I woke up in the middle of the night. Not even middle of the night. It was like 3 a.m. And I heard a lady singing outside my window.
Wow.
Humming to an old tune, in which I was too scared to look outside my window because it's 3 a.m. and there's nothing else was going on. It was just this lady humming outside my window. And outside my window is, like, it's, like, my front lawn. It's, like, an isolated front lawn. It's, like, very kind of, like, gated and, like, just walls.
Oh,
and
wow.
So, and there's no women at the house except for my mom at that time who's sleeping in my room as well. So,
oh, wow.
So then I told my mom the next day about it.
Yeah.
And my mom got freaked out and told me that my dad experienced the same thing earlier, like a couple months ago, but it was not singing, it was crying.
Oh, wow.
So that's the...
Do you have any idea who the ghost is?
I don't know. I think it's like, well, I don't really believe, I don't know. It's this is like we're getting the territory where it's like, it's like you believe it or not. Like, I mean, it's very, I don't have like a specific like set of belief, but like people have said to me that the one that saw the ghost, it's like we used to be colonized by the Dutch and for like 350 years, and I think my housekeeper told me it's just like, yeah, it's like this lady from the old colonization like era.
Whoa.
Freaky. Who died there.
Freaky.
Yeah, but it is freaky, you know. When you're hearing this like this lady singing, you're just like, I don't know what to do.
You're listening to Textbook CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the unceded Coast Salish territories. I'm here with Omar. Omar, how are you?
I'm good, Josh. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. Omar is here for the Tell Me About Your Paper segment. He's here to talk about a paper he's doing on shamans and witches and I guess kind of spooky figures in Indonesia of all sorts.
Absolutely.
That was a story about Omar's own experience with the paranormal.
Yeah, that happened this summer, just a couple
this
months
summer,
ago.
A fresh one too.
A fresh one.
Tell me a little bit about this paper. What class is it for, first off?
It's for my anthropology and religion class. It's a 400 level class, and recently we talked about just witches and like shamanism and its relation to modernity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where I, like, decided to do my paper on it, relating back to, like, where I came from, like, Indonesia.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, there's a lot of mysticism and, like, like shamans there still plays like a very crucial role in the society.
You gave me this example of why you might call a shaman. And do you want to explain maybe a little bit about like why you would call a shaman?
Oh yeah, so basically the cool things about like, you know, shamans in Indonesia, or at least like in Southeast Asia, is just like there's a lot of types of shamans, and a lot of them are catered to like very specific things. Let's say like the weather. There's a shaman or like a witch. I don't know how to like classify this, but they're called pawang, and it's a person who can control the weather, believe it or not. During events in Indonesia, a lot of the organizers would you know, call them, and then like, and they would do the service of like controlling the weather for that specific event. I asked my workmate once, because I used to work in an event organizing like company, and I was like, do you believe that? His answer was like, no, I'm like very skeptic about it, but like this one time, what I had to do was to make sure the coffee cup is filled with coffee and the weather will be just fine. And so you have to make sure that coffee is filled. Like if it's like empty, refill it back again. So this one time, like the coffee cup was empty, and then the venue started raining. And so they filled out the cup again, and then it just cleared up.
Wow. Yeah.
That, and he told me what happened, and he's still skeptic about it, yeah. But like it could be
these real like causal things.
Yeah, it's
like,
a very causal thing. Yeah.
Who are these shamans and like mystical figures? Like, are we talking about like describe what they would like might look like? Are they old, young?
Usually they're like older, like wiser people, yeah. And because they've spent a lot of time like, you know, looking for this like power and this like abilities to do certain things. I mean also the portrayal in like popular culture, it's mm-hmm. like it's always like old like people,
yeah.
Like, they're kind of like but the thing is like what I think is funny about this is like it could be anyone, like mm-hmm. it's just like we don't have a specific like kind of oh yeah you're a shaman or not. It's just like usually it's just someone who's like who just went out and like started to pursue this like idea, like having this like ability, and then I don't know, going through like black magic and stuff, and you can call that person a shaman. Mm-hmm. For all,
there seems like to be this thing that you're describing about like a relationship between the like urban space and like the countryside too. Like when we're talking about these figures, are they mostly coming in from the countryside, or is there like such a great demand in the city that you like want a shaman that's like specifically geared for city life? Like,
yeah, that's also interesting. I mean, I don't really know in terms of it's like something I'm still researching upon. But like, a lot of mysticism usually happens like a lot of ghost stories like happens outside the city because of modernization, like. A lot of that is starting to fade away, but then again, like the presence of these shamans in the city is not as prominent as it is in the village, but it's still there. You know, it's
right.
Not something they highlight to like people. It's just like, yeah, we have this. It's just like somewhere you have like, oh, do you have a contact to like the shaman? But like in the village, it's just like
it's like buying drugs.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah, tell me more about this paper. So, like, what are you, like, you're looking at some case studies, or are you looking at, like, just generally making an argument about it, or?
Well, I'm just, like, a lot of the debate is, like, you know, shamanism is fading away. Shamanism is something that, like, well, with modernization happening, it will, like, decay, or it will, like, disappear. Because, like, Indonesia is still a developing country. It's, like, it's not yet, like, a futuristic, like, modern country. It's still developing. But I would say, like, my argument is that, like, it will intertwine in a sense. at least for like, I personally believe it would intertwine. Yes, it's not going to be as prominent as it used to be, but, like, there's, like, this, like, people are very, I mean, Indonesian people are still very skeptical about things, and they're still, like, scared of things, so they resort to shamanism a lot. Like, a lot of people, I won't say, like a lot of people, but, like, some people nowadays, like, even, like, young people, they're still, like, they still go to that route of, like, contacting a shaman and whatever. And I would just, like, want to discuss how, like, the modernization intertwined with
yeah, well, there's, like, this, I guess there's, like, anxiety, too, right? Yeah, like, there's anxiety that, like, would suit that really well. What was I going to ask here? You were talking as well about, like, kind of the way that business is, like, often a big one for why people will call shaman. Like, that seems like another, like, really salient point.
That's a big thing. I mean, it's always a rumor. There's never, like, hard evidence of, like, oh, yeah, this business, like, went to a shaman to make sure it's successful. Because, like, there's a steak restaurant in Jakarta. And when was it? It was like 2007, 2006. It blew up. It's not even. I ate there. It's like not that great. It's like it's fine, but like there's a lot of hype, and like the place itself is not very like good. It's like a very worn down place, and they sell steaks, right? So people are very skeptical. It's just like, why is this place always booming? And then it resorts back to like, oh yeah, they must go to the shop.
Right.
And then someone told me about it. It's just like. Yeah, they have like they have this like entity that is being sent by a shaman to make sure that the steak stays good. So it's just like this like paranormal entity the building that will make sure that all the steaks like are good.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which I really like that.
Yeah, that's crazy, right?
Yeah. So there's this kind of like this kind of like haunting thing, right? Like the building itself like has this steak like ghost kind of thing. Is there like any sort of fortune telling or like oracle type stuff, or is it mostly like you go with a problem and you get that problem fixed?
No, you can do that the same thing.
The fortune telling is there.
That exactly. It's just like it's a very broad thing. Like they can do like things that like you want them to do.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Also, like voodoo is like it's also a big thing.
Okay. So explain the voodoo to me.
The voodoo,
because this isn't like this isn't like Caribbean voodoo. This is like
no, this is a different type of voodoo, and it's just like very scary. There's a story, and it was like on television. This one's on television because this lady started feeling like pain in her stomach, and then. They like open up her belly and they found barbed wires coming out of the belly, and it was just like everyone was just like shocked. It's like how the hell this happened? Yeah, it was either barbed wire, it was just like metal coming out from her belly, and it's just crazy. And there's no explanation to it.
And that's like that, voodoo. It's like the number one culprit.
But that's the thing. It's like scary. Like you don't want to make enemies in Indonesia because you can just like it's gonna be like war.
Wow. So was the sense like is it the kind of voodoo that like involves a lot of like substitution? Like I'm thinking like dolls when I think voodoo, right?
Yeah,
like is that really what it is? Like
I've never seen it. I don't know if it's like a form of dolls or it's like a form of like just things. But like usually, what they do is they just grab a random object and then they'll put like a spell or like they cast a spell in it and then they'll do something to it and then it'll just. Happen to the other person kind of thing.
Wow. Okay, so this is for anthropology of religion class.
This is anthropology of religion.
And the kind of like lay out the kind of configuration of faith here. This is like mostly you were saying before the interview, mostly like some sort of hybrid with like Islamic faith. What like explain that a little bit. How is that integrated into doctrine?
Okay, so Indonesia is like the country with like most Muslims in it. That's like a fact. Like we have like 200 people, and then 87% of the 200 people are Muslims, and a lot of these shamans like, you know, they're still very religious and they seek out this like power to do good things. You know, like it's because of their This is what people believe in. Mm-hmm. It's just like because they're very into it, they gain like knowledge and like power. That's because so like this is why we don't call it like a shaman. Like mm-hmm. usually we call it like orang pintar, which means a smart person, or it's like it's just a wise man. And they do help you with things such as like cleansing your house from mm-hmm. from bad spirits, let's say, or like exorcisms. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if like the next time I moved to Indonesia, we called one of them, like my parents called one of them,
right?
And then just to clean the house.
To clean, yeah, so, well, the yeah. house is yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So this is like yeah, so it's tied to knowledge, I guess, right? Is
yeah,
the idea?
Yeah, yeah. It's this idea of like knowledge and uh-huh. kind of thing.
And it's like, okay, so it's like, would they be, like, would there be connections here between, like, the kind of spells that are coming and the Quran, or is it like very much a different like knowledge set?
What I often see is like it's always something from the Quran.
Okay.
Yeah, it's always like a prayer from a Quran.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's super interesting. Yeah. Explain to me the exorcisms, though. That's also, like, absolutely out of this world. Like, possession? Like, we're talking, like, a full-blown...
Oh, yeah. I have so many stories about possessions. Like, like I have a lot of examples.
Okay.
One of my friend's mom... So I just got back from a show, and then my brothers were hanging out in front of my house, and... Oh yeah, in this gated like thing where I heard the noise.
Okay, right.
My brother and his friends were hanging out, and then they just started talking about ghosts. So I just I got drawn into it,
and I
just went there. And then my brother's friend told me about this. It's like, yeah, my friend's mom got possessed for 3 days, and all she wanted to eat was raw meat for 3 days.
Whoa.
They had to, like, tie her down, and all she was eating was raw meat. It's just, like, it's kind of, like, very, like, the exorcist
yeah.
moment.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah, and then, like, and then another example would be, like, there was, I used to go to, like, an elementary school 2.5 hours away from my house. I don't know why. My yeah. mom still asked me, like, it's like, why did I put you through that? And I'm like, I don't know, Mom. Like, that was your decision.
That's a commute, man. Yeah. That's a serious commute.
It's a serious commute. Yeah. I have to wake up at, like, 5, 4 a.m. in the morning every day. As a 6-year-old, yeah. that's very traumatizing.
Yeah. That's early, man.
It's irritating. But, yeah, so our school is, like, located in this, like, kind of isolated wasteland. And it's a great school. It's just, I don't know why it's located there. And it's nearby the village. And it's, like, surrounded by empty houses. So a lot of, like, possession would happen in my school.
Wow.
And I got told this once. My principal was trying to do, like, an exorcism.
Wow.
One of the vice principal, or, like, principal was trying to do an exorcism on this person alongside with this 8 shamans, and then they were doing it, and they were like, they were reading like passages from the Quran like one by one,
mm-hmm.
and when it got to like my principal's like turn to read it, as he was reading it, the possessed person like stopped moving, stared at him, and started laughing.
Oh my God, that's so creepy.
Started laughing, and she was like just taunting him. She's like, yeah, I'm not afraid.
Whoa.
But when it was the other people like doing it, they were like the person was just like kind of like burning kind of thing.
Okay.
Like, wow. Like shaking. But then it was to his person. And when it was like to my principal's yeah. turn, he was just like,
there's no way.
There's no way. Yeah.
Oh my God. That's great. Yeah. That's such a great twist on the like I'm like a teen like getting in trouble. Like
people will listen to this and be like, what is this person talking about?
No, I love it. It's just like the typical like teen bad boy, like, no, I'm not listening to the vice principal, like, no way. Like, even in possession, I love it. How has it been writing this paper, and like you have these stories from yourself, you have this culture that's like pretty close to you, that you're hearing these stories, you're hearing these rumors. How has it been like writing about this in an academic setting and having to like, I don't know, cite your sources? Like
that's the problem. It's really hard to cite my just like cite me last summer. My friend 2K12. I I don't know. I mean, I'm going to incorporate a lot of, like, personal, like, things. Because when I got back my proposal, like, she's very sad about it. She was, like, very happy that, like, I have, like, personal kind of, like, connection with it. And, like, I have, like, firsthand, like, evidence of things just from my experience. It's probably mostly just citing the paper. I would be, like, just relating it back to... There's a lot of books as well about this, and I found a bunch of one. I found a bunch of books about the voodoo in, like, this village in Indonesia, which I'm going to, like, incorporate.
Right.
And then... And usually, like, just, like, modernization and religion, which I'm going to do it. And